Lesson 33, Baudelaire, the setting of the romantic sun.
This is the first of two lectures on the poet Charles Baudelaire. And as the pronunciation of that name tells you, we are not dealing with an English language poet. And I want to stress that because whereas when we studied drama and narrative, I felt no compunction about working in translation. After all, we've got Sophocles, and we've got Moliere, and we've got Buchner, and we've got Strindberg, we've got Kafka. We've got numerous writers who are not writing in English, and we felt that it was appropriate to include them. But poetry, where you are looking very closely at the operation of language itself, is a far more dicey proposition to read it in translation. And you have to have good reasons for insisting on that in a course like this. So I want to suggest to you that it's because I have such a high regard for Baudelaire, see him as a kind of indispensable figure in the history of poetry, as a kind of pivotal figure, really as the kind of source of modernism in poetry, that I think he has to be included in any program that starts with Shakespeare and goes up to our own day. I hope I can persuade you of that as we go. He was hardly recognized in his own day. In 1857, he published the first version of the first edition of Les Fleurs du Mal, which means the flowers of evil. And the second edition was in 1861, and he died in 1866. However, already by the 1870s, he was seen in France as the father of French symbolism, which means that poets like Verlaine and Rimbaud were very much indebted to him, as the poet Mallarmé was. And then later, particularly with figures like T.S. Eliot, but also figures like Rilke, Yeats, there's a great recognition that Baudelaire is really the fount of modern poetry. He's the source of modernism. He took modernity, and particularly the modern city, to be one of his major subjects in a way that no other poet at that point had done. And I think to get a sighting on the curve of Baudelaire's career and on what is new and special about him in France, one of the great responses to his work was, c'est un frisson nouveau. It's a new kind of trembling. It's a new kind of tremor in his work. We can get a better sense of that by comparing him to his real counterpart, who is Whitman. They are really kindred spirits in some ways, even though I'm getting ready to outline some very great differences between them. So let's refocus on Whitman. Whitman's love of land and country, his democratic fervor, is utterly opposed by Baudelaire's contemptuous, aristocratic sense of marginality. And in that, Baudelaire is much more a prescient, prophetic figure than Whitman, because Baudelaire announces the split between the artist and the public. Whitman still believes that there is no split. He still believes that you can find me if you look for me under your boot soles. He really thinks that he is part of the body politic. Baudelaire knows that he's in the margins. Baudelaire already stands on one side of a divide between artists, bohemians, figures who are at the marginalized, peripheral figures, and mainstream society. And with all of the kinds of adjectives that come to mind, mainstream society that regards these artists as kooks, as nuts, as irresponsible, things that we have heard in our own society as well, and the artists, of course, who regard mainstream society as gross, vulgar, philistine, and the like. Baudelaire is one of the first to give us a report on those matters. That's not all. If we think for a moment about Whitman's organicism, his love and rapture for living things, his celebration of the forces of nature, his use of nature as a way of expressing his own sexuality, all of that is deeply opposed by Baudelaire as well. The best way to give you a sense of that is to cite part of a letter from Baudelaire. This is to a friend who asked him for some poems. My dear Desnoyers, you asked me for some verses for your little volume. Verses about nature, isn't that so? About the woods, the great oaks, verdure, insects, the sun, no doubt. But you know very well that I am incapable of becoming sentimental over vegetation, and that my soul is rebellious to that singular new religion, which must always hold, it seems to me, for every intellectual being, something rather shocking. I shall never believe that the soul of the gods dwells in plants. And even if it did dwell there, I should be only moderately concerned, and I should consider my own soul, as being of ever so much greater value than that of sanctified vegetables. I've always thought, even, that there was in flourishing and ever rejuvenated nature, and you think about that, flourishing and ever rejuvenated nature, that's the very stock that Shakespeare works out of, the contrast between that and human life. I've always thought that there was is in flourishing and ever rejuvenated nature something distressing, something hard, cruel, an intangible something bordering on effrontery. All right, so you ain't going to get poems about how nice it is to be in the woods, okay? Very, very different sensibility. This is a poet writing after the Industrial Revolution. He's writing at a moment when people start to live in cities. They don't live in the woods. Thoreau has to exit and build a place in Walden to even claim that you could live in the woods. People didn't, okay? So Baudelaire represents already our own culture in a funny way. That's not all. You remember the emphasis in Whitman, for example, on the seer-like dimension, the prophetic dimension of Whitman, Whitman who speaks for the whole country, Whitman who is the Maj figure, a very romantic posture. Baudelaire, on the contrary, is a very impersonal poet. His poetry is not confessional, at least not in any ordinary sense. And one way of characterizing this is to say that there are two views of poetry in the 19th century. One is the poet as seer, the visionary figure who sees into the future. And the other is poet as maker, craftsman. So one view would say a poem is a vision, and the other would say a poem is a bunch of words. A poem is a very careful, crafted arrangement of language. Oddly enough, Baudelaire's view comes directly from American sources, from Edgar Allan Poe, whom Baudelaire revered and whom Baudelaire introduced to the French. The French have a funny way of processing American materials. The French still believe that Jerry Lewis is the greatest actor on the earth, and they think that Edgar Allan Poe was the greatest poet in the 19th century. They are seeing things that some of us don't see. Nonetheless, Poe is interesting. Poe is interesting to Baudelaire, not so much as a poet, but as a philosopher. He wrote something, for example, called The Philosophy of Composition. And it's an elaborate document, which I think is partly a spoof, which Baudelaire didn't see, about how he planned The Raven. And he goes into great detail about how every metrical choice he made was designed to have a fail-safe reaction or effect on the reader. So it reads like a kind of scientific document. I wrote The Raven, I made each of these choices because it was guaranteed, like a kind of setting up a missile, was guaranteed to work its result on the reader if I did these things. Baudelaire loved this. This really confirmed his sense that poetry isn't sort of divine inspiration. Poetry is a shrewd man sitting down, working out the effects he can get with words. I should also say that Baudelaire, in a way that differs from Whitman, is intrigued by artifice. One of his most interesting essays is about makeup, women's makeup. He celebrates that. He takes the view that makeup is far more interesting than your original features. Because he says, more or less, and you could see that from the quote on vegetables, that nobody can help what they're born with, but you can all help what you do with it. So that, and one of the implications of this is that you become your own artistic material. You mold yourself. You shape yourself. Beauty is something that is crafted, just as a poem is, no matter the accidents of birth or of nature. And one of the heroes in Baudelaire's essays is the figure that the French, borrowing from the English, called the dandy, the elegant, dapper, dashing figure, the Beau Brummel type of figure, who strolls through the streets of Paris. This is a figure, Baudelaire wrote a great deal about this figure. This is a figure who is immensely constructed. He's a figure who absolutely crafts every component of his vestimentary allure so that everything is chosen to have a particular impact on the viewer. He also takes pride in being completely impassive. He never responds emotionally to what he sees. He is the blasé, bored figure par excellence, and he walks up and down the streets of Paris, a spectacle himself, taking in the spectacle of the city. Baudelaire enjoyed that. He thought that this was a form of mastery, a form of discipline, and a form of elegance. So that says, all of that you can see is really completely at the opposite end of the spectrum from a temperament and a project like Whitman's. So it's not surprising that he writes poems that are different from Whitman's too. The first poem I want to look at of Baudelaire's is called The Cracked Bell, La Cloche Fêlée. And I think it's an enunciatory poem. It's a poem that tells us something about the shifting gears in poetic production. It also is a poem that tells us a great deal about the workings of metaphor. It goes like this. You'll hear that it's a sonnet, by the way. It's a Petrarchan sonnet, not a Shakespearean sonnet, so it's got two quatrains and then a sestet. It goes like this. It is bitter and sweet during winter nights to listen beside the throbbing, smoking fire to distant memories slowly ascending in the sound of the chimes chanting through the fog. Blessed the bell with the vigorous gullet which, despite old age, watchful and healthy, throws out faithfully its pious tones like an old soldier in vigil under his tent. Ah, my soul is cracked, and when in sorrows it wishes to people the cold air of the night with its songs, often it happens that its feeble voice seems like the thick death rattle of one wounded, forgotten, by the side of a lake of blood under a great weight of dead who dies without moving amongst enormous efforts. I intentionally slowed down the end of that poem because it seems interminable as it ends. Well, this is a poem, as I said, that is about a new conception of poetry, and I think it demonstrates very beautifully the workings of metaphor. You note where it starts. It starts in a scene that we can all envision and probably have all experienced, sitting at night on a cold winter night beside a throbbing, smoking fire. It connotes a sense of security, of protection, of warmth, and obviously it sets the memories to going. Okay? To distant memories slowly ascending in the sound of the chimes chanting through the fog. He hears the chimes of the church bell through the fog. He can't see it. And the sound of that, connected with sitting by this throbbing, smoking fire, conjures up notions for him. And he begins to address the sound of the bell that he hears. Blessed the bell with the vigorous gullet, and immediately this bell becomes personified. This bell becomes the voice of a person, of a singer, of a speaker. Blessed the bell with the vigorous gullet, which despite old age, watchful and healthy, throws out faithfully its pious tones like an old soldier in vigil under his tent. And so we hear here a notion, first of all, that the churches themselves do with their chimes, in a sense, order the life of the community. It's a traditional model of the church providing that kind of structure. But here, the old bell, which now becomes the old soldier, it's like the voice of the soldier who still works as a sentinel and looks over the community and protects them. That is the traditional image, according to Baudelaire, of poetry. That is what one aspires to, that the song of the poet is like that venerable voice of the bell which takes on responsibility for the life of the community. Blessed the bell with the vigorous gullet. It's old, but it's watchful, healthy, and it's faithful to the community, has pious tones. And then we get the sestet. Ah, my soul is cracked. Classic procedure for a sonnet. Second part of the sonnet comes in and makes the metaphor work. That bell is what used to be the case. My voice is not like that. The bell is cracked. Ah, my soul is cracked. And here's what his song sounds like. And we can hear in this Baudelaire's announcement of what modern literature is. And when in sorrows it wishes to people the cold air of the night with its songs, it often happens, that its feeble voice, its weakened voice is what the French says, seems like the thick death rattle of one wounded, so that this voice is no longer that of the sentinel who guards over the community, but it's of a dying person who's been wounded. And watch the way this death just gets extended and extended and extended. Of one wounded, forgotten, by the side of a lake of blood, under a great weight of dead. It's as if you can't kill this person enough. He's not just wounded, but he's buried under a great weight of dead, and he's still dying, who dies without moving, and that suggests that he's trying to move and can't, covered by these dead bodies, amongst enormous efforts. It is a very, I think, clear notation of what his voice is. That's why he calls his poems The Flowers of Evil, Les Fleurs du Mal. In his dedication to Théophile Gautier, he asks him to accept ces fleurs maladives, these sickly flowers. He sees himself as the poet of sickness rather than of health, and he sees that as the only song he has. It's the only song he knows how to make. So a large pact is coming undone here about the traditional role of the poet vis-a-vis the community, the role that Whitman, again, embraces fully, the spokesperson for America, the bard for the democracy. Here we've got something totally different happening, and as I say, I think this is more modern. Also, I said to you, it's about metaphor. Can you see how drastically this poem changes place? You start on the inside, on a cold winter night, next to a fire, with all of the security that that offers, and you end up, by dint of metaphor, transported by the metaphor, which means transportation, you end up on the outside, dying by a lake of blood, buried underneath other corpses while trying to move. That is a very significant trek that the poem makes and asks its readers to make. You go from protection to terrible exposure, from life and nostalgia and thinking to death amidst terrible efforts. So I think it's a kind of textbook illustration of what the mission of metaphor is to link things together and to carry the reader from one realm to another. Going from one place to another is one of the deepest instincts in Baudelaire's life and his work. And the rest of this lecture is going to be about the ways in which Baudelaire works the notion of travel, or a voyage, as he calls it. There is a kind of deep romantic longing at the core of Baudelaire, even though it is accompanied by an equally deep cynicism that longing and yearning will come to naught. All of his poems are about the frustration of longing and yearning. Baudelaire is very much the contemporary of the French novelist Flaubert, and it turns out they knew each other, they were friends, and in 1857, when the Fleurs du Mal appeared, it's exactly the year that its counterpart in prose, Madame Bovary, appeared as well, which is also the death knell of Romanticism, about the impossibility of ever actualizing desire. And that's what Baudelaire's poems are about, except that he's not quite as dark as Flaubert is, that he manages to find a kind of poetic energy in talking about longing. And so we have the titles of some of his works. One of them is N'importe où mais hors de ce monde, anywhere but out of this world. There's a terrible yearning to get clear of the constraints of his life, voyage, escape, transcendence, and he seeks it in countless different ways. For example, he writes many poems about beauty as a way of getting clear of the monotony and the ugliness of modern life. In one of his poems about beauty, he says, whether you come from heaven or hell, it makes no difference. He also is wonderful at finding new subjects for beauty. One of his most famous poems is called La Charogne, which means the carcass. And it's about two lovers walking through the streets, and they come to the carcass of a dead animal on the sidewalk. And the poet explains to his woman that there is obviously a kind of carpe diem message here. We should quickly enjoy the possibilities of love because this is what is going to happen to both of us. But beyond what the poet says within the poem is the clear, obvious message that writing about a carcass can be a form of poetry. Rembrandt did this much earlier in some of his paintings about hanging meat and things like that. These are shocking because they break the canons and conventions of what acceptable subject matter are. But it says something about Baudelaire's obsession to make things beautiful. Remember what I said about makeup in women's faces and things like that, to create beauty. Travel, voyage, trip, tripping. Baudelaire is one of the great experts about drugs. He translated De Quincey's Confessions of an Opium Eater, and he experimented with hashish, and he wrote about its effects on him. And he writes poems about wine and about drugs. One of his prose pieces is called Get Drunk, Enivrez-vous, and it's all about getting clear once again of the dreary constraints of your everyday situation. Baudelaire is the poet of boredom, ennui, that life is terrible. We have to find ways, artificial or poetic or other, to somehow transcend this, to get beyond this. One of the most fascinating elements in Baudelaire's treatment of voyage is sex. He is one of the great erotic poets in the French language. Some of his poems that were censored when the first edition appeared were poems about lesbianism. He writes two or three, Les Femmes Damnées, the damned women, the women who were condemned, and also Lesbos. And he talks about the search for some kind of infinite pleasure that lesbianism might make possible. He also writes about heterosexual love poems, and I'm going to read you a piece of one, which is one of my favorites. It's called La Chevelure, which means the head of hair, but it's usually the head of hair as well. It connotes something almost of animal's hair as well as people's hair. It's not like Les Cheveux, it's La Chevelure, and you'll see what he does with this motif. It's a rather remarkable poem. It starts with a kind of invocation to the muse, but the muse is the hair of the woman that he loves, or that he is with, or that he's going to make love to. Oh, fleece, foaming to the neck. Fleece is what he says there. Toison is the French. Fleece with all of its legendary connotations of the golden fleece. Fleece with its animal connotations. Oh, fleece, foaming to the neck. Oh, curls, oh, scent of laziness. Ecstasy, and again, the literal meaning of ecstasy, ecstasis, to get from here, to leave here. That's the obvious state that a poet seeking transcendence wants, as a mystic would too. This evening, to people the dark corners of memories that are sleeping in these locks, in her hair, I would wave them in the air like a handkerchief. And the next stanza shifts gears entirely. It goes, languorous Asia and burning Africa, a whole world distant, absent, almost extinct, lives in the depths of your perfumed jungle. As other souls sail along on music, so mine, oh my love, swims on your scent. And her hair, and by extension her body, are going to be the means by which he makes his trip, he makes his voyage. And in saying it that way, I want to get across the double dimension of this. On the one hand, it is properly an ecstatic poem, and I'll read a little more on it to show you that. But I want you to see at the outset that it is a deeply exploitative poem, too. It's a poem that a woman is likely not to read the same way a man will. It's a poem about one person using another person for their means of locomotion, for their particular exit or entry. It's imaged in terms of a trip to an exotic port. I shall go over there where trees and men full of sap faint away. That's mistranslated. It should be swoon. Slowly in the passionate climate, O strong locks, he's talking about her hair, be the sea swell that transports me. You keep, O sea of ebony, a dazzling dream, a sea of ebony. We know that the sea is not ebony. The sea is blue, her hair is black. This is that kind of mixture. He's going to absolutely transpose these elements of herself and the desired landscape. You keep, O sea of ebony, a dazzling dream of sails and sailormen, flames and masts. And in the middle of this seven-stanza poem, in the fourth stanza, he arrives. You can call it orgasm, whatever you want. He arrives at the desired place. The woman disappears. She has achieved her purpose, a resounding haven where in great waves my soul can drink the scent, the sound, and color, where ships sliding in gold and watered silk. Notice this emphasis on richness, on fullness. You part their vast arms to embrace the glory of the pure sky shuddering with eternal heat. This poem is almost unpronounceable in its French in its effort to make it rich and laden with fullness. Here's how one of those lines goes. Ouvre leurs vastes bras pour embrasser la gloire. That's the sort of capture some of the richness, the almost insufferable richness of this. That's what he wants. And the second part of the poem, after this arrival, is the more scientific part of the poem, the reflective part of the poem. I shall plunge my head, and people have read this poem as a certain kind of sex as well. I shall plunge my head, adoring drunkenness, into this black ocean. You remember the ebony, sea of ebony, now we have the black ocean, where the other is imprisoned. He knows that one ocean contains the other. He wants to use one to get to the other. And my subtle spirit, caressed by the sway, will know how to find you. Saura vous retrouver is what the French says. Will know how to find you in the way a scientist knows how to repeat an experiment. Blue hair, he says at the end, again mixing up the ocean and her hair. You make the blue of the sky seem huge and round for me. So it's a poem, again, about voyage. It's a poem about getting clear of the straits that you happen to be in, of the body that you happen to be in. It's a poem about ecstasy. The greatest poem, perhaps, that he wrote in this vein is predictably called Le Voyage, The Voyage, and it is what you might expect to be the last voyage. It is what we just finished looking at in Dickinson's poems. It is death now, death seen as the final voyage, the final opportunity to truly get clear and to truly find something new. And I'd like to read you just a few pieces of this very full, long poem. It's a kind of grand finale for Baudelaire. And it's done in the fashion of questions that are asked to travelers who have returned from faraway trips. So it's a kind of series of questions and answers. Amazing travelers, this is the middle part of the poem, what noble stories we read in the deep oceans of your gaze. Show us your memory's casket and the glories streaming from gems made out of stars and rays. We too would roam without a sail or steam, and to combat the boredom of our jail would stretch like canvas on our souls a dream framed in horizons of the seas you sail. What have you seen? And the answer is, we have seen stars and waves. We have seen sands and shores and oceans too. In spite of shocks and unexpected graves, we have been bored at times, like you, or the same as you. And then the poem, as it reaches its closure, goes like this, of what they have seen. Oh, childish little brains, not to forget the greatest wonder there. We've seen in every country, without searching, from top to bottom of the fatal stair, immortal sin ubiquitously lurching. Baudelaire is, despite himself, a deeply Catholic poet. Here he differs entirely from the pantheistic Whitman. Sin is everywhere on his agenda. Woman, a vile slave, proud in her stupidity, self-worshipping, without the least disgust. Man, greedy, lustful, ruthless in cupidity, slave to a slave, and sewer to her lust. That's what they see. That's what the voyages have yielded. And so, it's not surprising how the poem is going to close. O death, old captain, it is time, weigh anchor, to sail beyond the doldrum of our days. Though black as pitch the sea and sky, we hanker for space. You know our hearts are full of rays. Pour us your poison to revive our soul. It cheers the burning quest that we pursue. Careless if hell or heaven be our goal, beyond the known world, to seek out the new. And so death as the final voyage, death only really as the kind of antidote to boredom, to the misery of routine, to what life has in the present. There really is something virtually systematic in Baudelaire's poetry, the way that every possible source of ecstasy is explored, with the final result, as you saw, that death is chosen. The one source that I have not yet spelled out and that will be treated perhaps more fully in the next lecture is the possibility that poetry itself could be a voyage, that the reading of the poem, the writing of the poem, that poetry could also be a way of getting clear of where you are, that it could, in a sense, contain all of the elements of the other trips. It could contain beauty, it could contain drunkenness and hallucinatory feelings, and we shall see, it could contain even something akin to sexuality and something perhaps akin to death. So we'll look at the actual poetic achievement of Baudelaire, not in these kinds of lyrical poems, but in different poems, poems about the city, in the next lecture. Thank you.